Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host. To know me is to love me, Lady P. No relation to Master P. And joining me today is a freelance writer for a whole host of movie sites and journals, including Screen Slate. Sugar may be sweet, but not as sweet as my girl, Caroline Gollum. Welcome back to the show, Caroline.
Thanks, Pauline.
Going with the informal Pauline.
Oh, I'm sorry. Uh-huh. Thanks, Lady P.
Yeah, all right.
I knew you before when you were still Pauline from the block.
That's true. It's true. Okay, well, it's been a while since you were last on the show, but last time you were here, we had an absolute blast talking about one of my all-time favorites, Johnny Guitar. And listeners, once you're done with this episode, you should definitely give that one a listen if you haven't yet. I'm just going to go ahead and assume everyone listening to the show has seen Johnny Guitar. I think that's fair.
And if you haven't, then log off right now.
Do it. Do it. Okay. Enough about Johnny Guitar. We have a second guest today. Making his FlixWise debut is a lonely soldier fighting in the war for film Twitter dominancy. Let's welcome to the show, Mr. Matt Prejet. Did I say that all right? Did I say your name right?
Yeah, okay. I was slightly worried you mispronounced the last name, and then everything would be terrible.
All right, perfect. And, thanks for coming on board, Matt.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Of course. And so on tap for today, we have David Lynch's 1986 surrealist noir fantasy, Blue Velvet. That's happening a lot today. This is the second Lynch entry on the Sight and Sound Top 250 list. The first being the number 28 film, Mulholland Drive. Oh. Mm. Can you guys guess?
Yeah.
I know, right?
Wise of them.
I would have gone with Dune, but that's just me.
We'll get there. But can you guys guess what number this is?
69.
Hell yes, it is.
Oh my god!
Wait, seriously?
Oh my god! Nice.
That's
Thank
so
you.
Messed up.
Nice.
Well, that's great.
Nicely done, guys. Nicely
Pauline,
done.
Pauline, I guess you could say that I'm a detective and a pervert.
Yes. Okay. Expect lots more. Dorm room humor like that, and dorm room insights, frankly, as we as we try to make heads or tails of Lynch's vision, and determine if it's worthy of the 69th spot. Of course it is. Anyway, and while we're on a Lynch kick, we'll also talk really briefly about Twin Peaks, not so much the specifics of the show. Not all of us are caught up, but rather about how Lynch and other film directors are starting to embrace television as the medium for thoughtful programming. And then we're each going to pick a filmmaker from any era in movie history, and we're going to give them a show to run. And we'll probably...
I have
maybe
mine
we'll talk.
Already.
You have yours? Okay.
Yeah, I prepared
I
for
cannot
this assignment.
Wait.
I actually forgot this part.
Oopsie.
I'll brainstorm something.
You've got like 40 minutes or so.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. And then we'll wrap things up with a final note of positivity. All right,
just
you guys.
Just like this movie.
Yes, exactly. You guys ready to get crooning?
Yeah, let's
sure.
do it.
All right. Can you give me a little sing-along? Here we go. Blue. Okay, first up, we have the 1986 neo-noir classic, Blue Velvet. Whoa, whoa, whoa. The film opens up on a series of brightly colored images of suburban paradise, a montage of tulips and gardens and white picket fences, with the silky voice of Bobby Vinton dreamily setting the scene. It appears to be another beautiful morning in America until, in typical Lynchian fashion, we dig a little deeper. Just below the surface of these perfectly manicured lawns and gardens lie vicious insects ready to start picking at our tender human flesh. The film is about this strange juxtaposition of good and evil and lightness and darkness and what happens when the light enters the world of dark and vice versa. Here the good is embodied by longtime Lynch muses Kyle MacLachlan and Laura Dern, playing Jeffrey Beaumont and Sandy Williams, respectively. Jeffrey and Sandy are a couple of naive middle-class teenagers who get wrapped up in a kidnapping slash drug heist mystery when Jeffrey stumbles upon a severed ear in a vacant lot near his house. Sandy, the daughter of a local police detective, fills Jeffrey in on some of the details of where this ear may have come from, and the two of them set out to solve the mystery of this aberrant lobe. Aberrant lobe. I like it.
It's also the name of my prog rock band.
Exactly. Thank you, Caroline. to find answers, they must cross over to the dark side, where people like Dorothy Valens reside. Dorothy, who's played by Isabella Rossellini, is a lounge singer being held captive by a drug-dealing, helium-huffing rapist named Frank Booth, who's played by Dennis Hopper. Through the course of the film, our plucky teenagers go further down the rabbit hole of terror and sexual deviance. Jeffrey, in particular, finds himself drawn into Frank and Dorothy's world to the point where the audience is left to wonder whether he can ever truly return to the light again. As with all Lynch films, Blue Velvet is rife for multiple interpretations of the themes and the meaning. One popular theory is that Blue Velvet is an interrogation of the infantilizing depictions of small-town life as seen in Reagan-era movies and television shows. It provides that Lynch is repurposing archetypes of melodrama and using 1950s nostalgia to provide a counterpoint for some of the most violent and disturbing images that Lynch's masculine, art-addled brain could conjure. The result has entranced film critics and freshman stoners the world over. But does this 1980s creation still offer that same mind-bending, whoa, man, reaction that it did when it first debuted? We shall discuss. All right, so you guys just watched this a few minutes ago, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
In the middle of a beautiful, sort of overcast day here in sunny central Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
To give you some context, I was at the beach yesterday and I'm really burnt out. I don't know what Matt went to Flushing yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, I went to Flushing. I'm also burnt out. I ate way too much food.
Perfect. Yeah, all right, so you had some...
Yeah, mm. I can barely form right. sentence.
Well, that should go really well then.
Yeah,
but so you're denizens of New York City, right? You're very familiar with this milieu, the darkness, right?
Well, there's darkness. There's the kind of anonymous darkness that you get in like a big city like New York or Philadelphia. Mm. I will count
yes,
that as a big city.
As the case may be.
Because they have a Major League Baseball team.
Birthplace of America.
True. And then there's like small town darkness, the likes of which you encounter in Lumberton. Mm. And I think there's really no party like a nitrous and huffing and Roy Orbison, small town, wrong side of the tracks party. Because here, if you're a seedy piece of shit, you can find a milieu of people that are also seedy, or if you're really just a bad person, you can probably get away with it in a larger way. Mm. And it's less simmering below the surface. It's just sort of all around constantly. Mm. Whereas in a nice little community like Lumberton, it's like you said, there's a whole seedy under thing beneath, full of bugs that are waiting to tear at our flesh.
Yeah. All right. Well, so, okay. What was your guys' reaction to watching this again after however many years it had been? I'm assuming you had seen it before.
Yeah, but I don't think I actually watched it all the way through in, like, 15 years.
Okay.
Yeah. It's... I mean, it's great. I mean, it's like, you know...
Is it?
I really like it.
Okay.
It's also, you know, I didn't really like it the first time I watched it, and I was like 16 or 17, and I was kind of watching it in like the guise of like, I had just discovered Quentin Tarantino because he was taking over the world, and we were all watching all these R-rated movies that were classics and we didn't know anything about, and it was sort of bored me at the time. It's a little slow for, you know, if you're into the Tarantino thing, it's kind of a slow movie, and it's a little cheesy in sort of 80s ways, which are, of course... the wrong opinions to have, I think, about this film, but it's certainly not as nuts as, like, Twin Peaks now, like, the new Twin Peaks.
Sure.
It's sort of, like, kind of like the urtext for a lot of, like, the David Lynch stuff, and a slightly more forward about what it's actually about, which is, you know, about, you know, the infantilization of a portrait of suburbia.
Right,
And the horrible bugs that are going to eat you underneath, and the communities of Lumberton-style places that have all this seedy stuff that's going on underneath. That is worse than anything in the cities.
It's very proto-Twin Peaks in that way.
Yeah, it is.
The town fathers that are just sort of like hovering above the fray of these really nasty things. And spoiler alert, you know, the cop that turns out to be a bad guy. Mm. And he's clearly a pillar of his community, but what is he doing on the literal wrong side of the tracks with these horrible people that huff and hang out at this place called the Slow Club? The best looking club I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no kind of like Agent Cooper, who Agent Cooper is sort of the embodiment of like greatness, like one of the most decent characters in television, or, you know, or like Harry S. Truman, you know, he's like the, or Hawk, or all these characters in movies who are like really kind of pure, as opposed to like people like Jerry Horn or Jerry Horn? Is he the bad? Is he the?
Yeah, Ben Horn.
Ben Horn. Okay, Jerry Horn's the delightful stoner. Ben Horn is the fun, is the evil, you know, proprietor of the Twin Peaks, whatever it's called.
The Great Northern.
The Great Northern. I don't know any details.
I haven't really watched the like first and second seasons recently.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of shit that I just don't remember anymore, and I'm fine with that.
Oh, I plowed through like the good episodes, and then I found no time for the bad episodes. You know, because there's like the 10 episodes that are really bad, so I think I watched that, and then the last episode, and then it was good.
Yeah.
So.
You're all cut. I think that's about right. Yeah. But yeah, so, but you mentioned like this is kind of the air text for the Lynch style, right? But prior to this, we have Eraserhead and Dune. So this, I don't know, would
okay,
you...
Okay, wait, Dune, hold please.
Yes, okay.
First and foremost, I'm going to go on the record here and say David Lynch's best movie.
Well,
second
okay.
most... Come at me, bro. At Caroline Avenue. I'll fucking fight you on the internet. Number three.
Okay.
Wait, did I skip number
you
two?
Skipped two,
was,
yes.
Was number two, come fight me on the internet?
Yeah.
Number three, all that stuff is there, but it's disparate, right? Like, in Eraserhead, you get the kind of experimental stuff that he will lean on and pepper throughout his movies, or it comes back later in Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire. But the... I mean, with the exception of The Straight Story, I guess, the seedy suburbia thing is a pretty prevalent theme, and I think this is him, like, it's a kind of like an exegesis of him spitting all of his harebrained ideas about how fucked up the suburbs are into one place and then coming back to it again and again because growing up in the suburbs fucks you for life and you never get over it, I think is the
I guess.
Larger message here.
And then you move to Philadelphia and get fucked up even more.
Right.
Yeah, and then you take up transcendental meditation.
Right.
And then you move
okay,
to
so, so yeah, so would you say that that is essentially that is what Lynch's whole filmography kind of boils down to is like, man, suburbs are dark.
I think more
there's darkness everywhere.
It's like a general... I'm speaking over you. it's more of a kind of like a general thing about how, like, we have this idea of, like, humanity being really kind of wonderful and peaceful, but underneath we're all sort of evil or contaminated by something that we don't really understand because we're always trying to understand, like, why the dark side of our nature, why there are people like Frank Booth. And so, you know, if you have something like the Twin Peaks, new Twin Peaks, episode 8, which is the one that, like, blew everyone's mind... That's sort of like an origin story for David Lynch's obsessions with, like, here is what actually caused the 20th century to get as bad as it did after World War II, I guess. You know.
It's the back-to-back ultimate evils. And I can't imagine that growing up in the shadow of that is going to give you a very rosy view of what humanity is and capable of as well, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And the suburban thing, I'm sure a lot of that is just, it's a combination of, you know, he probably grew up in the burbs at some point. I don't know much about Lynch's biography, but one can only assume... And then also, if you wanted to find the most effective shortcut to convey what America is about and why that's wrong or why that's a kind of flawed metric for how we gauge our success as a species, I think the American suburb is probably the best for that.
How so?
The suburbs were this idea that we thought we could control human nature and we really couldn't. So that's the thing that came around in the 40s and the 50s that we're gonna escape from all the horrors of the world and create these kind of gated communities and get away from that. But of course we can't.
Yeah. Okay. So then put that in the context of the 1980s. What was the attitude of sort of middle class America at that point? And how does that compare with the 1950s? I understand like there is this very strong 1950s nostalgia, the sort of Eisenhower era nostalgia.
And electing a two-bit fucking 1950s B actor to be the leader of the free world, too.
Sure. Yeah.
Let's not forget
they
that.
Went all in. I mean, that's like some desperation there. Please give us the 50s back.
Yeah, can we literally elect an actor from the 50s to be our president and make America the 50s again? Was what people were trying to do. Speaking of, can I bring this up? Because this was the first thing that I wrote down when we started watching this.
Go on.
Interesting that you mentioned this 50s nostalgia and talk about the opening being this incredibly kind of pastoral and calm suburban scene. But the credits on this, like, kind of blue velvet curtain in the back reminded me a lot of Douglas Sirk's movies. And I think that there's a lot of that. A lot. You want to talk about something bubbling under the surface? I think there's a lot of that shit brewing there, too.
Absolutely.
And the 1980s nostalgia for anything from the 1950s or 1950s melodramas completely misses the mark, which is what I love so much about it. Because those were films being made contemporaneously. You know, films being made in the 1950s about how sad and unfulfilling this life was, especially in a lot of Douglas Sirk's films too. But you get that in other movies about suburban life as well. People were hip to this idea. It's not like a bunch of cultural studies students suddenly woke up in 1980 and were like, the 50s were bad. Sure. People were hip to this the whole time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure David Lynch was hip to this as he was growing up in the 1950s too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, he's such a... he's an interesting guy, and he's sort of inscrutable in that he's so reticent to answer any questions with a straight answer. So, you know, he said things like he has admiration for Ronald Reagan, you know, that he really enjoyed his childhood growing up in, I think it was Idaho, and less so his family moved a lot or whatever. I like you, I'm not... I haven't kept careful track of where Lynch's upbringing, but I think that there may be some, like, I think we have a very ironic reading of the parts that depict the kind of sunny Archie comic sort of the high school experience part of Blue Velvet. But I also think there is a very sincere affection for it as well. Like, I think David Lynch loves Bobby Vinton, you know?
So, I think everybody in this conversation loves Bobby Vinton.
Well, this is, yes, very true.
Not me.
You love Bobby Vinton.
What?
I'm kidding.
Get out.
Okay. Oh, my God.
Episode canceled.
Sorry. I came here with virulent anti-Bobby Vinton stance, and I'm going to...
How do you feel about Roy Orbison, though?
Oh, he's the worst. No, he's great. Oh, sorry. I'm terrible. Totally joking. Okay. Sorry.
Anyway, Bobby Vinton, great. Established. I'm glad we got that out of the way. but yeah, I mean, do you guys get the sense that he is, that maybe we have a different reading on the material than David Lynch does?
I mean, possibly, but I don't think... Really, I think it seems pretty obvious, but I think, like, he's also, I mean, so much of David Lynch's work is about kind of this duality, like these, like, contradictions. So, like, he can both, like, really admire the suburbs and middle America and Ronald Reagan and be, like, well aware that there's, like, this dark underbelly underneath them, that they can be both rotten and kind of great at the same time. So, there's, like, kind of, like, really no way he's not, like, kind of an up or down rotten or fresh filmmaker at all. He's
much
more complicated, and it's like all through his work is all about people who are like one or two things that should contradict each other but somehow don't add up to something that's much more complex and impossible to parse.
That complexity is, I think, what makes these questions so puzzling when you wrestle with them watching his films, because, you know, you leave a movie like Blue Velvet and you wonder, why are there people like Frank in the world? Why is there so much trouble in the world? And David Lynch doesn't have an answer to that. He understands that the world that we live in is made up of, like, light and dark, right? You have the darkness, and then the Robins come in sometimes, and then sometimes horrible shit happens, and then two teenagers fall in love after solving a mystery, and it's a beautiful tapestry. And I think, like, knowing that there are no easy answers to those questions makes his work that much more rewarding, rather than just saying objectively, this is evil, this is good, let's root for these good guys, let's wish for the quick jettisoning of these bad guys. And speaking too about the past and this kind of nostalgia that people pick up on in his work, you know, we have a tendency, I mean, maybe it's just me, but a lot of folks, I think, have a tendency to equate nostalgia with a fondness. And I think you can be nostalgic for the past, you can yearn for the past and yearn for another time without really owning how fond it is for you. And you can acknowledge also that there are components of the past that you really enjoy and find very beautiful, and then there are also components that are quite disturbing. And the thing that made me think of this, and I guess maybe you were going to get to that later, was like the decor in Dorothy Valens' apartment is this kind of weird, like, it looks like a floppy apartment that, like, Raymond Chandler character would live in, right? Mm-hmm. It's this kind of, like, threadbare, like, velvet chairs and this Art Deco stuff, and it's really, like, seedy and ugly. And it's very lovingly set, and it's obvious that the movie was shot with a great amount of love for these kind of, you know, weird apartment homes and their ready-made furniture. But it's also very ugly, and it's an ugly reminder that people used to live in kind of sad and run-down places by themselves. Mm-hmm. People who didn't have families or neighbors or a block association to, like, check in on them from time to time. Mm-hmm. I don't know what people do in the burbs.
I think it's usually checking in every now and then.
Yeah.
Every three days.
Pick up the
pie in hand.
Vacation.
Making sure people are dead. Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't sound terrible.
No, it's nice.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the use of pastiche is kind of what gives a lot of the film its meaning, right? So you recognize this apartment as something from, you know, name a film noir. Give me a film noir.
Murder My Sweet.
Thank you.
I was going to say Murder My Sweet as well.
Well, we were
perfect.
Talking about
that's
fine. yeah, and then you mix that in with Douglas Sirk. That's absolutely there. So yeah, but the meaning comes in this kind of postmodern jumble, and yet there's something very Lynchian about it, no question. But let's talk about the performances, because I think this is sort of where I have the most trouble with this movie. And I'm just going to come out right now and say Dennis Hopper annoys the shit out of me.
No!
Yeah.
Is this the part of the podcast where we disagree with each other and then we talk as though we're never going to convince one another to think otherwise?
I mean, you can certainly try. I mean, and I know I am in the minority here. Most people adore that performance. And I just don't. I think he's so, I guess, bombastic, I guess. It's like almost, it's like camp if camp weren't fun, you know. I just feel like it's like, it's annoying. I find it irritating. But you know, that's me. What do you guys think?
Well, he's not that fun.
Yeah, he's not fun. Yeah.
Loud and abrasive. I mean, it's also like, it's sure. great, because it's also Dennis Hopper coming, like, right out of rehab, having, like, his career has been on the, you know, the downward spiral for, like, the last 15 years, with a couple kind of things like, you know, Apocalypse Now being a thing, and then really never going anywhere. And right. so he attacks it with this, like, great ferocity. But it's a total cartoon. But at the same time, I mean, like, Frank Booth is such a fascinating character, because, like, there's no way to rectify all his contradictions, going back to contradictions again. Mm-hmm. You know, he's, like, he's a horrible sadist and rapist. And he also cries at, you know, is it Bobby Vinton? Or who is he crying at?
No, that's Roy Orbison.
Roy Orbison. Like, he cries at, there's a couple of times. I mean, when she sings Blue Velvet at the club, like, he can be spotted crying. And then he's crying when Dean Stockwell is lip-syncing the Roy Orbison. He has this, like, weird capacity for, like, depth of feeling that he doesn't really understand. And which, but he plows through life with a weird kind of ultra-confidence, even though he himself doesn't understand himself.
True. Yeah, I think it's a very nuanced performance, and, you know, I wonder if a lot of the critiques that people lob at David Lynch's work is, this doesn't make any sense, or I think this is too much, or, and this is not to speak ill of your opinion personally, Pauline, I mean, like, more generally, or people say, I don't understand why he's doing that, or this seems so out of sync, it doesn't seem like there's any decision making here, I think he's just doing it to fuck with people, yada, yada, yada. A small minority of people say this, because as far as I know, in the circles that we run in, David Lynch is pretty well regarded.
We're in a really cool circle. So,
we only hang out with people who really like David Lynch.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's the first question when you meet people.
So, David Lynch, thoughts?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's as good a gauge as any, right?
But it's a vetting situation.
So, getting back to Dennis Hopper, though, I watched this movie, again, like a half an hour ago, but prior to that, I'd seen it, you know, a couple years before then, and then in middle school, and there was something this time around, and it could have been the Heineken, but there's something I picked up on this time around that I felt was really jarring to me, and it wasn't his behavior. It was how bad I felt for Frank as a character. Mm. Like, maybe I've just seen this movie too many times, or I'm also, like, a fucked up person. I didn't relate to him, but I looked at him and I thought, this poor man, like, he is a monster. Yes, he's a total sadist. He is a rapist. He's holding this woman's child captive. He has a million and one horrible peccadilloes. This guy would make an analyst richer than the king of Saudi Arabia. But you have to look at somebody like that, even as a fictional character, and think, who made you like this? And how did you get this way? And that kind of weird, internal, unavoidable darkness that people carry with them, I think, is in so many ways more frightening than the darkness that exists around in the shadows of these worlds where the movie takes place. Mm. And his performance, especially where he oscillates, you know, like Matt says, between being an absolute monster and then crying at the sound of a song, or you know, the way that he looks at Dorothy sometimes. I mean, most of the time he looks at her menacingly, but every once in a while he'll look genuinely wounded. And what can I say? I'm a sucker for Dennis Hopper, and I just think this performance is so good because of that. Mm. Like, I wasn't expecting to walk into this movie feeling anything for this guy. And this time around, I felt really bad for... I mean, I feel bad for everybody in this movie because they're all ruined for life. Mm. But, you know, I felt a little bit worse for Frank than I did before. I had some sympathy for him.
Yeah, I think that Lynch does that really well. He'll always take, like, monster characters and then give them these, like, weird, unexpected moments of humanity. Mm. And that happens, like, throughout his movies. I mean, even something like maybe Willem Dafoe's character in Wild at Heart. Mm-hmm. I think maybe almost the fact that he's, like, sort of a caricature himself, like, that almost kind of makes him sort of human in some kind of strange way. Mm. That might be harder to defend.
Yeah, or Leland Palmer.
Or Leland Palmer. Yeah, Leland Palmer. Mm-hmm. But Leland Palmer is,
possessed
heart,
by a demon.
Possessed by a demon, at heart, a decent human being, a little frazzled.
But aren't these guys all just kind of possessed by demons from time to time, like, in their own way?
Yeah.
You know, if you want to take that literal representation and apply it to everything, I think that's not unlike what's going on here with Frank. I also think Dennis Hopper does an amazing job of taking his delivery to, like, new and disquieting angles. Like, we were talking earlier about the use of fuck as a noun, where he says, you fuck! And, mm-hmm. like, he'll hit these, like, weird beats when he does this shouting that's comical, I think, because you have to laugh to keep from crying or screaming.
Yeah.
But it's still entertaining to me to watch him. You just wind him up and watch him go.
He's
like the Tasmanian devil.
Mm. Maybe.
He bursts
into
these rooms like the Kool-Aid man, but it's poison Kool-Aid.
I like that. I guess
never
it's sort of
part of my... The Kool-Aid man. I'm really glad Kool-Aid you compared man. Him to him.
Yeah. I guess part of my problem is maybe it's my sheltered suburban upbringing, but I never encountered evil like that. I've certainly encountered evil, I guess, but it's never been in that form to me. He is a pure movie creation. Just everything about his delivery says big movie villain, very, very scary dude. So the idea that this person would be the leader of a gang to me strikes me as just silly. And I guess I mean, the whole idea that this movie should have any kind of basis in reality, I guess is we can question that. But for me, the character seems kind of hollow. Maybe that's my issue. It's more just like this guy is going to be as evil and weird as possible without any real anchor. So, I don't know. But I guess, you know, that's my opinion. Clearly, I am in the minority here because he is ranked among the greatest movie villains of all time, blah, blah, blah.
That's a title that isn't even remotely worthy of Frank Booth as a character. Mm.
Yeah.
He's beyond, I mean, I think he'll to call him a movie evil. Villain is almost misleading. I mean... Yeah, he's archetypal in that way, but I mean, so is Jeffrey Beaumont as your archetypal high school or college age drip who gets into too much trouble.
Right.
Or Sandy Williams as your archetypal girl next door, you know? Or,
right.
I mean, he's a movie character because it's a it's a movie about caricatures, I guess. Mm-hmm. Caricatures of suburban living. But what I like about him and what I like about his coterie is that they're almost like a suburbanite's nightmare of what the outskirts of town are like. You know, if you drilled into the head of somebody who moved to Levittown in the 1950s, or what's another suburb? King of Prussia.
King of Prussia.
Moved to King of Prussia in the 1950s. In their mind, you know, you ask them to dream of a bad guy. The first thing that props in their head is probably a drug dealer, because mm-hmm. drugs are evil. Mm-hmm. Not really, but we think they are. Obviously, he has to wear a bolo tie, because mm-hmm. that's what bad guys wear.
Yeah.
He drives a Cadillac, also a major bad guy trope. He has, and he hits women, mm-hmm. and is cruel to children. And hides out in a warehouse. It's like a children's idea of where bandits live. They have a little hideaway, mm-hmm. their little warehouse hideaway, and you have to drive literally past some tracks to get there.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know. It's like bad guy bingo.
Sure.
Or bad guy yeah. Mad Libs, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There's one tangential thing I noticed at the very end I never noticed before is that they have the cookout at the end during the, like, over-idyllic, like, conclusion of the film. In the background, you can see Jack Nance's character, who is part of his coterie of gangsters. He's, like, hanging out with the dad, just, like, cooking, like, nothing. This is not even explained. I guess he had an
awesome.
About face. He's still wearing the hat. He's still wearing, like, kind of the bad guy.
I bet Jack Nance was like, David, you gotta give me one more day on this production. Just put me in the background somewhere.
I'm so bored. I have nothing to do today.
All right, Jack. Get in there for the cookout scene.
So there's, like, something about, like, maybe even, like, the bad guys. There's something. They have hidden amounts of depth in them. And they can kind of eventually conform into, like, the suburban utopia that happens at the end of the film.
Yeah, and young Beaumont has his own kind of weirdness, too, as we established. Earlier today when watching this. Sure. She has a secret reserve of what Matt calls smarm.
He's so smarmy in this movie. Mm.
Well, it's the earring, do you think? Possibly?
It's totally the earring and the convertible. He wears black button-down shirts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like power ties, but he's 21.
Yep.
He looks like a paralegal.
And he's hitting on like an 18-year-old high school girl, and he's like stealing her from her football boyfriend.
Pulling up outside the school.
And he's always trying to impress her all the time. Just like, yeah, Heineken, King of Beers, as though he knows what he's talking about.
I like jazz clubs. I'm a cool guy.
Yeah. He's like, I always kind of misremembered him as sort of a Tabula Rasa character who is just kind of like, descends into this world that he doesn't understand, that he's not prepared for, and he just watches as it happens. But, like, he's a lot more smarmy than I thought. It's, like, almost like, here's what this kid deserves to go through.
Mm. Yeah, he's got the good facade with the bad shit simmering underneath in total spades. And even in that scene where he hits Dorothy when they're having sex, or making love, I guess as you would call it, he smacks her, and then he's, like, about to hit her again, and he looks like, and maybe this is just me going, oh, Kyle MacLachlan, you're such a great actor. But I'm pretty sure he's totally pulling this. He, like, hits her, and then he, like, pauses for a second and is like, what am I doing? And then he hits her again.
Mm.
And that is, I mean, that's, like, beyond smarm. There's smarm, and then there's hitting people, you know.
Right, yeah.
That peak out, you know, it's the mm-hmm. earring and the Cadillac and hitting bitches.
Yeah, and he hides in the closet while she's undressing.
I know, ew.
Yeah. Who's actually the evil one in this movie, I ask you?
He's not, because he's a cutie.
He's adorable,
part,
isn't he?
There's that Kyle
MacLachlan couldn't be. Not Agent Cooper.
But there's that part where Frank Booth, like, turns to him when he's in the back of the car and he says something like, you're me, or something like that. Like, we're not all that different, and that's, like, really one of the big
themes. Come now, Mr. Bond. We're not so different, you and I.
He's stroking a white cat in it, too.
What's that?
Never mind.
Old time James Bond joke.
Yes, yes.
They are very similar. They both wear all black. They have the same haircut. Mm. Dennis Hopper also was kind of like a clean, fresh face at one point.
He was the Kyle MacLachlan of the 1950s.
You know what? Print it. I think he was. I have nothing to back this up, but you said
either.
It with such conviction.
Okay.
Kyle MacLachlan
would
definitely
think,
been.
What are you basing that off of?
Giant, I don't know.
Giant,
no, nothing,
okay.
Nothing at all. No, nothing at all. I don't know.
Petticoat Junction.
Because, I mean, like, Kyle MacLachlan is, like, a pretty boy who has, like, a weird bit of edge, like, a very kind of weird sense of humor.
Yeah.
I'm pulling this theory out of my ass. I have no idea.
I love it. Keep going.
They're, like, you know, they would probably be, like, you know, he would be rough equivalent to Kyle MacLachlan would have probably had the roles that his Hopper had. He'd be, like, the angry son in Giant. He'd be, like, hoodlum number three, like beatnik evil beatnik mm-hmm. number three in Revolt Without a Cause or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
Petticoat Junction, sense. He said he was
at? Yeah, he was a beatnik on Petticoat Junction.
Yeah, Comic Lock would have totally been on Petticoat Junction yeah. back in the...
100% he would have been on Petticoat Junction.
Yeah.
I love it. That's actually pretty brilliant. I love that.
Of course, their careers, you know, swerve from there. Dennis Hopper would have never been in Showgirls, so...
And what a shame, too. That. Could you imagine?
Like Apocalypse Now, Eric, Dennis Hopper, and Showgirls.
Oh, my God. That would have been great. How do you take a perfect movie and make it perfecter?
Put Dennis Hopper in it.
I know.
It worked for Waterworld.
Okay, I don't think we have bestowed nearly enough love onto the greatest actor in this entire movie.
Wait, hang on. Let me. I know who it is.
Come on now.
It's Dean Stockwell.
Yes. No, right Laura on. Dern. Come on now.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, she's
what was
amazing,
that?
Yes.
Laura Dern. I love yeah, Laura Dern. Right. She's
like
good in
soul.
Everything.
Yes.
She's great at acting bewildered at how stupid Jeffrey is.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. Also, the look on her face when he goes into her apartment and she like makes up a reason to stay behind so that she can watch him go in there. It's like watching a person like run their tongue over a canker sore. Mm-hmm. Like she keeps looking at him and you know that it pains her to do this and it's like this painful, annoying thing. But she just keeps like kind of coming back to him even though she knows she shouldn't and he's bad news. He's a loner and a rebel, a detective and a pervert, mm-hmm. a sinner and a saint. All these things and more, and she just can't get enough. And I buy it. Like, she is a totally believable high school age girl.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, she has like a depth to her that's very wise beyond her years.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She's always had this old soul. I mean, she's like 18 years old in this movie, and she has like the soul of like a 50-year-old or something like mm-hmm. that. Like, yeah. She just seems like all her reactions are full of intelligence. She's not at all the sort of like blank face, boring, dull, bland girl next door who's really sweet. She has so much going on underneath her, which is like maybe one of the reasons why she like falls for Jeffrey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think she has one of the harder roles in the movie. I think it's difficult to play someone who is good, and I don't know that the script gives her much. But yeah. I think Lynch allows her to become, gives her the space to make Sandy a real person, to his credit. But I think she takes what she's given and brings it to a whole new level. And I mean, that's why we still talk about Laura Dern all these years later. And while we're on the subject of women in the movie, Isabella.
The greatest.
What do you guys, yeah, man.
I mean, yeah, why not? She's great. What else am I going to say about her that only reinforces how magical she is in this film and how beautiful and how bewitching?
Mm-hmm.
She gives another performance where you think, like you said, there isn't a whole lot there. And I think that that's a description that you can apply to just about anybody in this movie, which might just be a testament to the fact that you don't need a lot of script to make a compelling film with great characters in it. Mm-hmm. Apparently, or so I've heard.
Sure.
She is, I mean, we know her only because we see what parts of her Jeffrey's allowed to see and the parts of her that Frank is allowed to see. Like, we never see her by herself unless she's being watched by somebody or she's in the possession of somebody else. Mm-hmm. So, for a character whose entire raison d'etre in the film is to be a plot device without any kind of autonomy, I think she does an amazing job of conveying that autonomy. And I think she does it by totally mind-fucking Jeffrey Beaumont from the minute she sets eyes on him.
Ooh.
Because every abuser, you know, learns it from the person that abused them in turn, right? I mean, not mm-hmm. every, but there is a tendency here, right? So I think in this kind of food chain of abuse and maliciousness, you've got Frank, who's treating her like a hostage, and he rapes her, and he's terrible to her. And she is powerless and has this thing that she can exert some power over. I mean, the fact that she stumbles upon Kyle MacLachlan in the closet and she takes this knife out and it's this major phallic symbol and then she almost gives him a blowjob. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, to say the least.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's interesting. So you think he is her victim?
That's my pet theory. Interesting. It might not be true.
Okay. Huh. I mean, I... That's tough. You're right. There is a lot to unpack there. I would he continues to go back to her. And he certainly has, over and over again, he has every opportunity to back away, go off, be with Sandy, or go back to school, and he chooses to go and have sex with her.
And get deeper into this morass of filth.
Exactly. Yeah, well, I think we've like touched on most of the things I wanted to address here.
Haven't talked enough about Dean Stockwell.
I know. Is it true? I read somewhere that he based his performance off of like the Carol Burnett show or something like that.
Oh, that would make a lot of sense.
Totally makes sense. there's again sort of it's almost borders on parody kind of. But it totally works. Everything about like the bad guys in this movie everything about it is way over the top. So it makes sense, the sort of variety show, sick, twisted variety show element.
But he's capable of surprising people. I always kind of like am shocked by the part where he actually like punches Jeffrey in the gut, that he actually does that. That he would actually kind of like dirty himself up to like actually stoop that low, to stoop to Frank's level.
Because he's so effete too, you would never expect that.
Yeah, and he loves Frank, and you have no idea why. And Frank loves him, and you have no idea why.
Where do you suppose those two met? They felt it, and they just felt a kinship.
A horrible place. Prison, probably.
Yeah. That makes sense. Well, on that note, I think it's time for the final question.
Is it already time for on that note?
No, hang on. We got the 69th movie on the site.
Can I just say one thing before we transition? Hardy Boys dash cam. I'm glad I got it in.
That's true. That was my favorite part of the movie, now that you mention it. That's pretty adorable. Okay. And on that note. this is the 69th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. Is it worthy of the 69th spot? What do you guys think? Just so you know, just above it is Sunset Boulevard.
What?
We've got a series. We've got two Bressons. We have A Man Escape and Pickpocket. We have, what else? I don't know. And it's tied with Blade Runner. And I think... Nice. And like Grand Illusion and Saint-Soleil.
Okay, well, first of all, I think ranking movies is an arbitrary and foolish practice.
Absolutely.
Is that the right answer?
That given. Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Second of all, if any movie was going to be number 69 on this list, and it wasn't going to be Sunset Boulevard, it might as well be Blue Velvet.
Sure.
Sunset Boulevard should be like number 15 on this list, but
who am I to judge? Yeah, no, Sunset Boulevard is way too low, that's for sure. I think Some Like It Hot should have been 69 personally, but
what's number one on this list?
What's that?
What's the number one movie on this list?
Vertigo.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. The new greatest film of all time.
That's right, yeah. All right, well, Matt, what do you think? Number 69?
Sure. Everything that she said is pretty much correct, and I can never top it. It was...
Okay.
Yeah.
Done. All right, 69.
Oh, no.
Yeah?
No, 69.
69 is good?
That's perfect for a really, really messed up movie about sex. That goes to some places that are truly uncomfortable that
And it's like, if you want to just stretch this to its most ridiculous point, it really is like a 69 between the ego and the id. You know?
Thank you. I think somebody just found their dissertation. All right, let's move on to present day David Lynch. The idiosyncratic director has been making headlines recently for his Banana Pants reboot of his much-loved network series, Twin Peaks. When the show initially aired in the 1990s, Lynch was one of the few American auteurs to embrace the medium of television, at least at that time. However, the contemporary cable and streaming models of content production, which allowed creators control over their series, has managed to lure film directors into making their own television shows. We're going to talk about why some filmmakers like Lynch have had great success in this new medium, and others like, say, Woody Allen have stumbled. Then we're going to offer up some suggestions to Netflix or Amazon or whatever. Take your streaming model of choice for directors that we think they should tap to make a series. Okay. All right. Well, let's start, first of all, Twin Peaks. I know we touched on it earlier. What do you guys think?
It's great. I love it. I watch it every week.
Okay. All right.
I'm giving you a Dougie Jones thumbs up. So.
Okay. Perfect.
Favorite part of the new Twin Peaks.
Is it not Dougie?
It's not Dougie. It's definitely Evil Cooper. It's the picture of Evil Cooper in Rio, or wherever he is, with the white jacket. And also, whoever's in charge of the casino, that character actor, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
The guy who played the Jewish comedian on Mad Men.
Yeah.
I love that guy.
Patrick Fischler.
Yeah, Patrick Fischler. He's remarkable. I love seeing him play the casino boss.
He's great in Mulholland Drive, too.
He is.
He's a Lynch regular.
I had no idea he was a Lynch regular.
Well, he's in these two things.
In my mind, he's always the Utz Are Better Than Nuts guy. I hope he doesn't spend the rest of his life like that. Listening, Patrick.
He's also in the first Atlas Shrugged movie.
Ooh.
Oh, of course, yes. The Atlas Shrugged movie, the one I was first in line to see.
I was just trying to get us to talk about the Atlas Shrugged trilogy, the trifecta.
Success.
Are there further installments?
Well, they had to make the three because it was always the plan, and then they kept running out of money because no one went to go see them. So they had to recast them each time. The first one stars Taylor Schilling. Well, I don't know why I'm talking about this. Taylor Schilling is whatever her name is.
Yes.
I've read these fucking books. She's the star of the first one, and they replace her with, what's her name from Pump Up the Volume? Samantha Mathis.
Know.
And then the third one.
Oh, poor Samantha Mathis. Wow.
That's the new Taylor Schilling. So.
Wow.
Who's Taylor Schilling?
Aww. Taylor Schilling's from Orange is the New Black.
Piper.
She's Piper. She's the lead on Orange is the New Black. Even I know this.
I've never seen that show.
I've seen five episodes. Aye.
The only TV show I watch is Twin Peaks.
And Mad Men.
All right.
And Mad Men, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, then you're definitely the perfect person to tap for this subject. Great. All right. Well, so do you then have thoughts on why some directors work well in television, others do not, Caroline?
I don't know. When you brought this up of like directors that work well in television, the first person that came to my mind was Michael Mann, because Miami Vice is often name-checked as the sort of primordial soup of prestige television. It's the vat from which all others have crawled. The neon vat.
Yeah.
Where everybody crawled out of. And I think Miami Vice is a perfect show, even when it gets into, you know, kind of more formulaic procedural territory in the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth seasons. The show is great. It's a treat every time. It's like a speedball made of cotton candy. So, I love Michael Mann, but didn't he also have that show about racehorses where the horses kept dying?
Yeah.
Is that Luck?
Lucky.
Lucky.
Which is apparently, I've never seen it, but apparently a really good show, but they were killing horses.
They were going through these horses like fucking tissue paper.
Turning them into glue.
Oh, no. That's so awful. So, I guess Michael Mann is somebody who does it really well. But I think he started in television, did he not?
And then
No, I mean, he started in, like, low-budget films and found himself in television because he has Thief, and then he has a film he made before that, but he, like, stumbled onto the TV. So.
And he did that,
Just The Keep as well.
The Keep, yeah, and he had another police show that was supposed to be pretty good.
Yeah, I'm forgetting what that's called, but apparently
Dennis Farina was in it.
Yeah. It was a short-lived show, but apparently very, very good. That's the hard-boiled thing. But, I mean, like, I feel like also he's really interested in crime stuff, and that, like, lends itself to television.
Yeah,
like,
crime really is great on TV.
I actually don't know a whole lot of auteurs who are really that terrible. I have not suffered through the Woody Allen, Miley Cyrus TV show, although I hear it's not terrible.
Couldn't pay me to watch that trash.
I'd watch it.
Not for all the tea in China.
I'm a Woody Allen completist, but not much of one, because the show aired a year ago, and I still haven't watched it. But there haven't been a whole lot. I mean, like I think a lot of the great filmmakers have gone over the TV. Steven Soderbergh,
that's an obvious one. The Nick was that one. That was the one show that I watched that year.
Oh, okay.
And nobody else watched it, and I was so butthurt about it.
I screen-wrapped it, whatever it's called, recapped it for my publication. So,
Where were you? We could have talked about how great that show was.
It's such a good show.
And it's like never coming back.
No, because he had a perfect ending, and now he's back to making movies, and he's learned so much through television because, like, he learned about, like, you know, he's all about kind of paring down, his technique and banging out shots in as few shots as possible, and like it just energized him.
He took a learning annex class, but that learning annex class was directing an amazing season of television that nobody watched.
He's someone who didn't need to learn anything, and he's just constantly learning new things and trying out new things. And whatever that thing with Sharon Stone he's making, which even he can't describe, it's like not a TV movie, but it's not a movie.
He's got that heist movie coming out, it's supposed to be pretty
but
good.
I do think good. There are more opportunities in, say, French television for French filmmakers to make TV shows, right? Like
they don't have the same kind of TV shows that we do, though, right?
Yeah,
don't they do that sort of weird seasonal? Six-episode shit that they do in Europe.
I don't know if they do it in France. They definitely do that in England, because there's a whole thing where it's like, we're going to have quality over quantity, which is such a great idea. So, like, every episode of, like, The Office is really great, and, like, you can go back and rewatch it, but then there's, like, 1,000 episodes per season of The American Office, and, like, you know.
It's lousy.
No, it's a good
show. How dare you? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good show. It kind of fell off a lot, and I was like, why am I still watching this show that's not very good anymore? But anyway, I mean, it's like, there's so many episodes to get through, and, like, there's, like, a little bit of fluff here and there, so.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. Yeah, but I mean, so, it depends on what you mean by a television show, too. Like, Fanny and Alexander is a television show, but
Berlin
it's...
Berlin Alexander Platz, a mini-series event.
Exactly, yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, like, TV's such, like, I mean, yeah, as much as we're in this, like, golden age of television, I kind of feel like it's, like, sort of, like, uncharted country.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, there's, like, or an undiscovered country. Like, people haven't really been exploring what you can do with the medium, and I feel like David Lynch is, like, one of the only ones who's really doing something. I mean, The Nick is great, but it's, like, very much, like, oh, it's just, like, director-driven TV and, like...
prestige period drama.
Yeah, it's, like, him subverting the, like, not even that much, like, subverting the kind of, like, prestige drama thing that's touching on interesting ideas and topics that are really important. And, like, David Lynch is just, like, I'm gonna take this in, like, a radical new direction. I don't really agree with the people who are saying, oh, it's definitely a movie, and, like, it will work better when you literally sit in the theater for 18 hours and watch it all in one fell swoop, which sounds horrible.
Nobody's got that kind of time.
I think it works really well having, like, the week space in between, because you're able to see each episode as its own discrete element, and you get to have the space between to kind of slightly forget about certain things and enter into it with, like, you know, an open mind.
And the time, too, like, the way that the time of this season is laid out is really curious, because we talked about Janie, you know, that scene where she's at the doctor's office and she's looking at new, updated Dougie, and it's really just hottie Kyle MacLachlan looking super slamming, as he does in everything, because he is the platonic ideal of male beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And
really?
I mean, he looks like a statue, dude. So she's looking at him, and you realize, like, why is this woman just now noticing how hot her formerly dumpy husband is? And it's because that B-plot or whatever is only taking place over 48 hours that you're seeing stretched out over 14 episodes.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Like, she hasn't been with, like, she keeps talking about, oh, 3 days ago he came back and we don't know where the car is. And, like, has it been 3 days? I feel like I've been sitting with these people for fucking 2 months now, right? Yeah. It's been two months,
yeah.
Oh, my
months. There's so much playing with time, you're not sure, like, are they all operating on different timelines, and you really don't know. This will be fun for Reddit when this is all over and they figure it out, but, like,
sure.
I think it's just fun to have it kind of like a loose thing.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Keep it breezy.
Yeah, because he's not a very scientific, he's a very instinctual. He's like, he said himself, I'm not an intellectual, I operate by instinct, so that's sort of the way to approach him, I think.
That's really rad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Intellectuals but suck.
Yeah, screw them.
Yeah, fuck those brainiacs.
Nerds.
Ivory tower elitists.
Poindexters.
Smarty
pants? Smarty pants?
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting point you bring up, though, that there isn't, despite the sort of influx of film talent, there hasn't been all that much experimentation with the medium beyond what David Lynch has done. And that's
recently.
Kind of why everyone's all in a tizzy about this whole Twin Peaks thing, right? It's like, so it's so unusual. But I mean, can you think of any other really, really interesting TV shows that beyond just prestige? These are very important, but rather like messing with the form in a very fundamental way.
In general?
Not really.
The first thing that popped into my mind was Trailer Park Boys.
Okay.
Here's why.
Wow.
One, it's a fantastic show. I highly recommend it. Two, they've managed to maintain the same format over the course of 25 years. The basic premise of the show is that they're being filmed by a documentary crew. And it's just become, like, even though the technology has changed and the characters have gotten older, it just, that's their forever context in which we're watching these guys fuck up at a trailer park in Nova Scotia. So they just keep that going, and it's also extremely experimental in terms of the schemes that they come up with. It's not as experimental as going into the Holocaust center of a nuclear weapon experimental. Unfortunately, you want that highfalutin stuff, you gotta get it a little further south than the good old US of A. But up in Canada, they're doing some pretty kooky stuff with Trailer Park Boys. That's also the only other television show that I watch right now.
I mean,
I'm poorly versed in the medium, I'm afraid.
I mean, going back a long time, like almost 40 years at this point, I would say like a good show that I wish people emulated more, which is like The Young Ones, where like every single episode, they sort of have like a restart thing. Have you ever watched The Young Ones before?
No, what is The Young Ones?
It's like, you know, it's like the British show. It's like, it's sort of like, oh, four crazy guys in a house that, you know,
oh,
they
the
have
one
no
with
money.
The punks and stuff.
Yeah, there's like a punk guy, and there's like the anarchist who's like really pretentious, and then there's the hippie, and then there's the guy who's like much more confident about his like way with women than he really is. And because he's actually a very bad womanizer, but every episode, like they'll die multiple times. Like at the end of an episode, they'll just die. There'll be an explosion, and they'll all die. And then the next episode, they never reference it. And I wish they would do things like that more often, which is like exploding the idea of like television standards, like having a punk rock anarchist kind of like quality to it.
Yeah, sure. Like a human cartoon.
Yeah, there should be more human cartoons. I wish this, because I actually watch way more comedies than I do dramas. Like Twin Peaks is one of the few hour-long shows I watch. Rick and Morty is more.
Oh, Rick and Morty. That the jewel in the crown of contemporary animation.
There's also BoJack, which is also...
BoJack is different, though. Rick and Morty, you know, I feel like I actually am smarter for having watched that show. BoJack, I just watch it and I think, oh, I'm so glad I don't live in L.A. anymore.
I'm so glad I'm not as depressed as BoJack Horseman.
Being depressed in a paradise is the absolute worst.
All right, but anyway, so if you could give, let's wrap it up. But if you could give one director a TV show that hasn't already gotten one, obviously, who would you give it to?
Can I have one living and one dead?
Sure.
Or do I have to pick one?
Yes.
Okay, living.
No. You can do both. Yeah.
I don't know. Does Terry Zwigoff have a TV show yet?
He should.
Is he working on a TV show?
I don't know. He's doing.
I heard that he works in reality television, but I wish I could get like 30 minutes to an hour of new Terry Zwigoff every week.
That sounds good.
He's a very strong contender. Or Anna Biller. Give Anna Biller a TV show.
Sure. I'd watch that.
I want to see her do an entire season of television where she is in charge of every single fucking thing that goes on in there.
Yeah.
Because that's her greatest strength, is running everything.
Yeah.
Being in charge of everything.
So what would her show look like?
God, beats the shit out of me.
Okay.
I wonder, maybe like a fun show about a girls' college in the 30s.
Mm.
Like The Group, if The Group was a TV show.
I like it.
Or a detective anthology show.
Mm.
Or The Twilight Zone.
Like
an anthology type program. Playhouse 90. She could do like a good Playhouse 90 reboot.
I like it.
And
dead
director? Douglas Sirk.
Oh, my God, that was my answer.
That would be amazing.
You're kidding. Because he gives the family, or the family gives, what's her name, a television at the end of All That Heaven Allows. Maybe if Douglas Sirk were making television shows, he wouldn't be so contemptuous of it, you know?
Yeah. I don't think the TV is the real villain in that scene.
Not so much. Yeah, no, but those kids are monsters,
I don't know what his show would, I think he would do, like, Peyton Place.
Or
he would do like a soap, you know. I mean, I know that's the obvious answer, but I would love to watch him do a multi-family messy drama where everybody's backstabbing everybody.
Mm-hmm. Was Peyton Place basically like them trying to steal Douglas Sirk for TV?
Might have been. Like a cultural exchange between the originator of the form and the cheap TV bastardization of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just like TV now.
Well, Peyton Place was a movie with Lana Turner?
It was. I don't think it's a Douglas Sirk movie, but the show is soapy AF.
I mean, like, the Peyton Place movie, the original one with Mia Farrow, was that basically just, like, we're going to do Douglas Sirk to Douglas Sirk, basically?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. It came out, like, 57, so it would be, like, towards the end of his run, so.
It's true. Maybe they were trying to catch some of that magic.
Yeah. I mean, they were hugely popular. Imitation of Life was, like, what? Like, Columbia is, like, number one grocer until Airport or something.
Man, it's remember amazing. Living in a time when people made good movies popular?
Boggles the mind. I do not, actually. It was so long ago. All right, Matt, what you got?
Okay, I, off the top of my head, came up with two, and they are both living, unfortunately.
Okay.
One, I would actually love to see a Charlie Kaufman show, because, like, it takes him forever to get anything done, and I feel he might like blow all his deadlines and fuck this up or whatever. But I would love to see like an anthology style show, like Charlie Kaufman's Twilight Zone. Not with a kind of like sci-fi element so much as like just him. Here's one funny, incredibly bottomlessly depressing idea every week for 30 weeks.
A new low for humanity.
A new low every for humanity. Week. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That would be really fun. He has a lot of great ideas and he's also a funny man in person. So you can do this. I mean, like, no one, like, Hollywood's not giving him money, and he should just go to TV. Like, he should just, like, bite the bullet and say, okay, film is dead, no one went to go see Anna Melissa. Everybody, because, I mean, his idea for Synecdoche in New York, he thought that would be really popular. He was like, this will make, like, $80 million at the box office. It's the most depressing, amazing
That's adorable.
It's so cute. Because I've been there before where I'm like, oh, I have this great idea for, like, this really funny, depressing thing, then everybody's going to love it, and then no one likes it because no one likes depressing things. But anyway.
Right.
My other one is I would love to see Claire Denis do a TV show because it would make, and especially if she's like in the realm of like The Intruder or something like that, or even Bastards, where like the plot really doesn't make any sense. I feel like there's much more. I really like one thing that's been great about Twin Peaks is that these shows it just confounds all the TV recappers and they're like trying to figure it out and like. You know, it's like, if you liked David Lynch not making much sense, wait till Claire Denis gets her hands on it, and there's no way of interpreting and plot summarizing what you're watching.
All right. So I have just one more to throw into the mix. I would give just about anything to see an Agnes Varda reality show.
About Agnes Varda?
Yeah.
Because Harrison just Ford would swing by every now and then.
What's that?
Harrison Ford would swing by every now and then.
Absolutely. Yes, that's right. I would watch the shit out of that. And truly, we can make this happen. Let's make all of these things happen. It's time we reemerge from the darkness and enter back into glossy cheeriness with some final notes of positivity. Caroline, what's one book, song, television show, not that you watch television, article of clothing that you've been digging lately?
I got a couple. I really enjoyed this film that I watched recently called Last Summer, which I have no idea when your episode will air, but it's playing at Metrograph the second weekend of August.
Okay.
As part of a Fire Island series. Ooh. And I am going to miss it because I will be, ironically, on Fire Island. But I watched the film because I was planning to write about it, and I really enjoyed it. I feel like a big Frank and Eleanor Perry thing coming on, even though they just did the series at the Quad, right? And
I missed the whole thing.
I missed the whole thing. So I could have gone to see all these fucking movies in a theater, and now I'm going to have to watch them at home like a chump. And then I just finished a book that I really enjoyed called A Hell of a Woman by Jim Thompson. If you like hard-boiled stuff and you like the seedy, dark side of heteronormativity... Man, well, Jim, that guy, I think I was actually screaming when I read the last page of that book. I think I screamed and cried.
All right. Wow. Okay. Matt, what you got?
That's a good question. I didn't even know about this part. It was probably in an email and I missed it completely. I recently read Down and Out in Paris and London by George Orwell.
Ooh, yes.
Which was really fun because I read it right before I got laid off. And it's all about poverty. And it was really bleak. But it kind of took me back to, like, I was never, like, that poor or anything like that. But there was a period, like, my lost years when I didn't have a job and I was, like, really poor. And I had to, like, scrounge together things. And it, like, kind of brought me back to that in some kind of way.
That youthful urgency.
The thing where you can survive on almost nothing. Like, you know, you don't have to eat for, like, well, it never got even remotely this bad.
You weren't, like, Little Dorrit or something?
I was not, like, Little Dorrit, no.
But it's good to know that, you know, should things go south, you at least have the romance of being a young, you know, a tramp. Young vagabond, right?
I'm making myself out to sound like the Little Tramp, and I would never.
But you could like hitch a ride on a boxcar, or like, you know, something I remember about that book very vividly from the last time I read it is the way that those guys put their shoes in underneath the legs of the bed.
Yeah.
I always thought if I was staying in a hostel somewhere, that would be a really good trick.
There's a lot of good tricks for being poor in that book.
Perfect. I like that. That's okay. So I have one more final note to add. I just watched A Royal Scandal. Have you seen this?
No. Mm-hmm.
It's the Ernst Lubitsch movie where he had to quit halfway through because of he got sick and Otto Preminger took over. I know.
Yeah.
Isn't that nuts? There's an Ernst Lubitsch Otto Preminger collaboration out there.
Passing the torch from one fat, horny Austro-Hungarian to another.
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, it's not a masterpiece, but I'm just going to tell, like, I know, but...
Despite having the Lubitsch touch, it's not a masterpiece?
It doesn't have enough of the Lubitsch touch, but it does have Tallulah Bankhead, Anne Baxter, and Charles Coburn, which makes it worth watching. But my actual final note here is that the movie features Vincent Price in a bit role doing a French accent. So whoa. I think that alone worth the price of admission.
I love Vincent Price.
Mm-mm-mm. Indeed.
A treasure. It's hard to believe one such as he even walked the earth.
It's so true. Mm. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what do you think of Blue Velvet? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com. And you can come tell us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if you want to come yell at me for not fully appreciating Dennis Hopper, you can find me on Twitter. Or better yet, if you agree with me, I would like to not feel so alone in this opinion. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, you should go to iTunes, subscribe, rate us, and leave us a nice comment. If you don't, well, I'll do more singing, and nobody wants that. Probably. But to be honest, I'll probably do more singing anyway. But so you should do it just out of the goodness of your heart. Go and rate us. Coming up on the next Sight and Sound entry, we have Sans Soleil and Blade Runner. I'm not sure which one we'll be discussing first, but pretty sure you're going to want to turn in for both. And we might also do a favorites entry and a FlixWise Canada along the way. I will let you know. Again, yet another reason to be on the social medias, because that's where we post the updates. But until then, Matt, it was a pleasure having you on the show today.
Thanks.
And if people want to find you on the internet, where should they look?
Oh, Twitter is fine.
Oh, Twitter.
Where the yelling happens.
Yeah, the yelling's great, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is there a handle?
It's MATTPRIGGE
Twitter.com.
At Twitter.com.
you're so special you get a Twitter email.
I don't actually know how Twitter works.
I think that's about right.
I just hit a keyboard a bunch of times and then and then post. Sometimes I bang my head against it.
All right, Scareline. It's been real.
Hasn't it, though?
Where can people find you on the internet?
Also on Twitter, because I don't have a website. I have to make one eventually for other things. Oh, on Twitter, @CarolineAvenue, spelled out AVENUE. Also, if you are in New York or outside of New York, and you are a Screen Slate subscriber, that's probably the only place where I contribute film writing with any regularity. Other than that, I'm just farting into the ether a number of ill-informed and noxious opinions that sometimes have accompanying photographs. I hope you enjoy it.
Oh, I do. Thank you. All right. Well, again, you sure know how to end a sentence. I can't very well end the show with you farting into the ether. So I think another sing-along is in order.
Okay.
She wore blue velvet.
Whoa.
Bluer than velvet were her eyes.
Whoa.
A candy-colored clown they call the Sandman tiptoes to my room every night, and just a sprinkle stardust and a whisper, go to sleep, everything is all right.